I grew up in a Catholic house, so I think when I talk to my mom today, this will count as going to church today, so thank you for inviting me today. We've heard from Matthew 25 today, which reminds us to welcome the stranger. The Bible is filled with stories about foreigners, strangers, sojourners, and refugees. In fact, it's a book written by refugees for refugees. Let's not forget that Adam himself was the first refugee. As both the Old and the New Testament were written by people in search of their home. In both books of the Bible, the stranger and the sojourner are never spoken of in any other terms but that of welcome. Besides Matthew 25, I'm reminded of another scriptural passage that speaks of the foreigner, but in a different way. This passage moves us beyond somewhat that concept of the stranger and the sojourner, removing the idea of someone who lives outside or beyond our community. I think it's a passage that's vitally important for this upcoming week, as we are anxiously awaiting to learn the fate of DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an executive action passed by President Obama that gave temporary deferred status to some undocumented children and teens. And I'd like to read you that passage today. It got me thinking this week as I was preparing for today's talk. It's from Ephesians 2:19, and it says, "So then you are no longer strangers and sojourners, but you are fellow citizens with the holy ones and members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the capstone. Through him the whole structure is held together and grows into a temple sacred in the Lord. In him you are also being built together into a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." I sometimes wonder if the message of welcoming the stranger is always the most appropriate for the situation we find ourselves in today. In many cases, the people we work to invite into our congregations through movements like the New Sanctuary Movement, into our homes and ultimately into our hearts, are not strangers at all. They might be the mother who emigrated to this country 20 years ago to pursue a better life for her children. They might be the daughter who is a recipient of DACA, born in a country that she never has known because she was brought to the United States before she could walk. Or they might even be the grandfather who counts his grandchildren in the 10s and the 20s living by his side here in Madison. The idea of welcoming the stranger, however, still rings true for those of us unconnected to those immigrant communities and individuals. Despite the terrible political situation we find ourselves in today, we have been granted, I believe, an opportunity to seek fellowship and sisterhood and brotherhood with families that have lived by our side, who have worked with us, who have been integral members of our communities for years. That is what drives the New Sanctuary Movement, that sense of invitation, of companionship, of creating a world of fellow citizens where we can all be members of the household of God. Now, for my comments today, I have been asked to lean more towards the inspirational than the educational, but I will warn you that I am a historian and a teacher, so it would be hard for me to at least not give you a mini history lecture before we get into some of our inspiration. I'm a historian of Latino communities, of religion and social justice movements, and I believe strongly that it's imperative that we understand our historical antecedents so as to better illuminate the path forward that we have in 2017. I emphasize the historical to remember that we are part of a long tradition of people who perhaps have not always seen immediate results from their commitments, but have yet maintained hope. The 1980s sanctuary movement emerged in response to massive migrations caused by civil wars in Central America throughout the second half of the 20th century. Political revolutions in Guatemala, which had a 36-year war beginning in 1990, and El Salvador, which had a decade-long war beginning in 1980, killed more than 250,000 people and forced the exile of more than 2 million refugees. The United States, however, in its efforts to stave off the supposed spread of communism in countries near its southern border, played a key role in these conflicts by supporting right-wing paramilitary dictatorships and covertly supplying weapons to those governments. As violence and repression in Central America escalated, more than 1 million refugees fled to the United States throughout the 1980s. Many of those refugees sought official political asylum through immigration channels here in America. Of those applicants, however, less than 3% received asylum in the U.S., a notable difference from the 60% approval for applicants from Eastern European and South Asian countries. As the number of refugees arriving in the U.S. continued to grow, faith leaders in border states began crafting a coordinated response. In July of 1980, with border agents apprehending growing groups of Salvadorans in the Sonoran Desert outside of Tucson, Arizona, immigration attorneys turned to local churches and pastors, including Tucson's Southside Presbyterian Church, their pastor John Fife, and the Quaker Jim Corbett, for help in securing the release of these refugees. Southside Presbyterian mobilized area churches to raise bail bonds to secure the release of the Central Americans, shelter refugees awaiting deportation hearings, and offer legal support. Increasingly frustrated, however, with the irregular application of refugee law and the summary dismissal of Central American asylum requests, Corbett pressed Southside Presbyterian toward a deeper involvement in providing aid by asking it to house undocumented refugees. Understanding that defying immigration policy meant breaking federal law, the congregation voted to publicly proclaim themselves a sanctuary for Salvadorans and Guatemalans who had been denied asylum. And so on March 24th, 1982, Southside Presbyterian announced that the church would become a sanctuary for Central American refugees. With media on hand for a press conference, Fife and Corbett contended that the Reagan administration had actively misclassified Central Americans as economic migrants instead of political refugees to conceal the American government's role in destabilizing countries like Guatemala and El Salvador. Early sanctuary participants thus raised the question of whether it was refugees or the federal government that was guilty of breaking the law. Within a few months of the establishment of the first sanctuary in Arizona, religious communities in cities across the country stepped forward to offer asylum to Central American refugees. This movement was interfaith, multi-ethnic, multiracial, and built on the shared concept of fellowship and solidarity. That movement included Milwaukee and Madison, which offered 16 sanctuary sites throughout the 1980s. In March of 1985, our own city of Madison passed a resolution supporting sanctuary. And the following year, Governor Tony Earle passed a similar resolution for the entire state of Wisconsin. A different situation than we find ourselves in today. Throughout the 1980s, laity and Episcopal leadership demonstrated a willingness to step outside the bounds of what was considered acceptable public discourse for people of faith, so defined by politicians, and I'll even say the Pope, to support a movement they deemed to be fully within the bounds of church social teachings. Clergy and laity were willing to denounce conservative politicians that advocated an immigration policy inconsistent with support for the poor, the destitute, and those who had been pushed to the margins of society. Movement participants, both American-born and Latin American-transplanted, believed that gathering support for the movement meant evangelization to raise the moral and social consciousness of their communities and the nation at large. Calling their acts unconcealed acts of faith, clergy and laity understood this as an obligation as members of religious communities. For these congregations, the movement became a place where morality and not legality was the dominant question at hand. Challenging churches to recognize their intrinsically political nature as social institutions and forcing congregants to acknowledge, as theologian Gregory Lightfull has noted, that the pastoral had become the political. We are now more than three decades removed from that original sanctuary movement, but its message, its tactics, and its goals continue to guide us. We've even seen the term sanctuary expand beyond its original religious connotations as municipalities, states, and even college campuses across the country are calling upon elected officials and administrators to declare their spaces as sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants and for refugees. The spirit that moved in churches and synagogues during the 1980s sanctuary movement, a kindling of political and social consciousness, has animated religious spaces across the country again. What do we mean, however, when we talk about sanctuary? How do we define it? I would argue strongly that in order to create this sacred dwelling place in God, as Ephesians calls us to do, sanctuary must also be more than a physical space, more than an opening of a congregation's doors to someone fearing detention and deportation. The etymology and history of the word offers a deeper meaning. Sanctuary comes from the word sanctus, the Latin translation of the Greek word hagios, itself a translation of the Hebrew word kadosh, a word used in the Hebrew scriptures for what God is and for what the people of God are. So when we talk about sanctuary, we are referring to holiness, something basic to our identity as believers in faith. It is nothing marginal, it is nothing peripheral, it is actually the heart of the matter. Sanctuary isn't merely the opening of doors of a church or a synagogue. It is the very essence of what we aspire to be. I've had the honor, through my doctoral research, of interviewing many members of the Wisconsin Sanctuary Movement during the 1980s, including Ruth Hosnoski, who was a Milwaukee lay leader. And she told me, when describing the work that she envisioned in Milwaukee in the 1980s, she said, when the refugees left the church building, they were still in the sanctuary of the church, because the church is the people. We can look to Scripture to embolden us in this idea. Psalm 46 reminds us that God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Psalm 42 tells us that sanctuary is also more than a passive safety or a secure hiding place. It says, defend me, take up my cause against the people who have no pity. From the treacherous and cunning man, rescue me, God. It is you, God, who are my shelter. Listen to those words closely. Defend me, rescue me, take up my cause. These are expressions of advocacy and liberation. Rennie Golden and Mike McConnell, two leaders of the 1980s sanctuary movement, tell us that sanctuary then isn't merely a safe space to hide in, but a prophetic platform to speak out from. It is a sanctuary of action, a plan of struggle. As a course of action, a plan of struggle, as a prophetic platform, sanctuary then has two primary objectives. The first is humanitarian. We, of course, need to focus on the individuals who are fearing detention and deportation, who might easily be separated from their families and from their communities here in the United States by the federal government. Keith Egan, a professor of theology at Marquette University, offered in the 1980s that sanctuary stood out as an extraordinary measure for extraordinary circumstances. Milwaukee's Archbishop Rembert Weakland, who in 1982 became the first Catholic archbishop in the nation to support the sanctuary movement, once said, "Sanctuary is not a way of avoiding justice, but a holy respite so that justice can eventually be done." As we provide reprieve against deportation, the government is thus forced to pause so that injustice, the injustice of arbitrary deportations, might be avoided. Sanctuary, however, cannot simply be about individuals. We know that there are more than 11 million undocumented persons in this country, and there is no possible way that faith communities can provide shelter for all of them. Sanctuary and the movement that develops to support it must also be a form of protest to force our nation to reflect on its laws and its priorities and to stimulate a reconsideration of public policy. By halting deportations and arguing for modified immigration and economic laws, we as a movement are demanding that the government act justly and humanely. I found in my sanctuary work over the last year that we as advocates are often tempted to point to a certain individual now in the White House for instigating this sense of fear in our immigrant community. And in many ways, the 45th President of the United States has been responsible for the terror that is gripping our communities, and he has spurred the reemergence of the sanctuary movement that since the election has grown to nearly 1,000 congregations nationwide. But before we dump all of our disgusts and our diatribes upon the current administration, we must remember that the struggle did not begin with the current president, nor will it end when he's eventually out of office. The deportation machines now at the current president's fingertips were created by previous administrations and have been imagined and shaped to support an economic system built upon the backs of immigrants. And this is an important point to remember, and a timely one, considering tomorrow's commemoration of our country's labor movement and the workers that have built this country. Our struggle cannot only be against an individual, but a structure, an immigration system built upon an economic model based on the law of gain, the maximization of profits, and the very degradation of human beings. In this sense, immigrants are nothing more than a reserve pool of labor to be used, spent, and then disposed of when they're no longer needed. A change is required in the fundamental economic priorities of the American system. And because we all benefit from this system, we all have a role to play in protecting our immigrant sisters and brothers, to work with them to disrupt the very system that means to degrade them, to strip them of their humanity, and to deny them entry into the household of God. So what is our call to action? I turn to my favorite scriptural passage, the light that guides my advocacy and my academic writing, and that is Micah 6:8, which reads, "He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." Justice and mercy must be our touchstones. Justice and mercy require us as people of conscience, as people of faith, to actively assert our God-given right to aid anyone fleeing from fear of deportation and persecution. Elie Wiesel, perhaps one of the greatest advocates for refugees in the last few decades, a man who spoke from his own life experience, saw those who joined the sanctuary movement in the 1980s as having, what he said, the courage to care. And that's what we must display now, a courage to care for immigrant sisters and brothers, not because it is heroic, not because we are powerful, and certainly not out of pity. We must care because it is the right thing to do. We are called to bear witness to the distress of our undocumented sisters and brothers. We have faith that there is a better way forward, a more complete understanding of fostering communities, one that builds up instead of tearing apart. The New Sanctuary Movement thus calls to commit acts of conscience by opening our congregational doors and our individual hearts to all members of our community. We are ultimately called to these acts to ensure that we can all be fellow citizens with the Holy Ones and members of the household of God. Thank you.